Views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and contributors, and not necessarily those of WFSU Public Media.
What's the 411? You're tuned in to 411 Teen. 411 Teen is a weekly program for teens and other interested folks. 411 Teen provides a forum to examine and discuss various issues and events that confront, intersect, and sometimes interrupt our daily lives. Sex, College, and Social Media by Cindy Pierce weaves together expert opinions, personal anecdotes, and feedback of today's college and high school students to help them make those difficult conversations a little less difficult for everyone. I'm Dr. Liz Holyfield, and joining me via phone, author and educator Cindy Pierce. In her new book, Sex, College, and Social Media, A Common Sense Guide to Navigating the Hookup Culture, Cindy has created a resource to help young people and their parents navigate the hookup culture. Cindy, welcome to 411 Teen.
Thank you so much for having me, Liz. I'm excited to talk.
Oh, I'm looking forward to having you. Hey, you confront a number of issues that young folks and teens, college students, are most uncomfortable or afraid to ask. And you provide strategies for successfully navigating our complicated world. You encourage the development of a strong sense of self. What was your impetus for writing the book, Sex, College, and Social Media, A Common Sense Guide to Navigating the Hookup Culture?
Well, what I have found over the years, and increasingly as social media has really become dominating kids' social lives, and what I really am finding is that the bar is low for the expectations for what sexual relationships should be like and what sex should be like. And when I see kids, you know, if the hookup scene, if I was hearing from college students and high school students mm-hmm. that the hookup culture was so great, the sex was great, everyone was emotionally and physically fulfilled, I wouldn't be doing this work. But what I'm constantly hearing is that it's not working out that well, but they think they got to keep at it to figure it out.
Why is the bar so low? What has influenced it?
I think porn culture is a huge part. And okay. I don't just mean internet porn.
Mm-hmm.
But I think there's so many messages coming to kids through social media, through the culture, through porn culture, media marketing, that there's this idea of what's put out there of what sex should be like.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really, you know, porn, particularly internet porn, skews expectations. I hear this from particularly from young men all the time, that it's, you know, real sex isn't actually the way it is portrayed in porn.
Mm-hmm.
So they feel a letdown, but they feel like it's just them. And so when they're getting these constant reminders of what they could be, should be, would be, if they had, if they did, if they bought, from all of these sources, there's this constant reminder that they're not enough.
Mm-hmm.
And kids, you know, even though they know that people cultivate what they put on social media, they can't help but fall for that and mm-hmm. feel that they're not enough and they're the ones who are not really living up to it. So they keep, even though they know better in one sense, the relentlessness mm-hmm. of these messages keeps them striving for something that, you know, they think
they
is out there.
Achieve.
And, you know, and I think that then they feel like, well, this is what everyone's doing. And perception drives a lot of behavior mm-hmm. around hookup culture. So the perception that everyone's having this great sex life, it causes people to say, oh, I guess I got to get on board. And if I keep at it, it'll eventually I'll figure it out. But what they're finding is their practice of whatever kind of sex they're having becomes their practice.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if it requires, you know, being drunk, and if it requires, you know, lowering your standards of who you're with, that's
mm-hmm.
kind of that's the expectation. So they go with it. And, you know, I just think there's so much that's really eating away at kids, mm-hmm. making them feel like they're not enough. I think that's the bottom line.
Feeding into their anxiety and their low self-concept. And when you have a poor self-concept, you know, that makes you vulnerable. I mean, it's just a vicious cycle.
Yeah,
before,
I agree.
But you touched on a number of components, but I'd like to have you define for the listening audience who and what is the hookup is the hookup culture.
Okay, you want to talk about the hookup culture?
Yeah, who and what, if you didn't hear me, is the hookup culture.
Okay, so hooking up is a conveniently vague term, and the why I say conveniently, because mm-hmm. if you're a kid who's just come to college or you've just come to a school and the pressure is, this is kind of the way we do it. This is, we go to parties, we drink, and then you hook up with someone. Mm-hmm. And a kid feels like, oh, I guess this is how you do it. And social relevance is important, and being part of the club. And really, the hooking up is not really about the sex. It's more about joining the club mm-hmm. and checking the box so that people, you're part of the scene. And so hooking up could be anything from kissing to snuggling to oral sex, to intercourse, to anal sex, to threesome, a foursome. So this is a broad spectrum, and it's very convenient for someone who is participating to avoid judgment by keeping that vague for everybody. So if one group of your friends may judge you for hooking up, mm-hmm. you can make it seem like it's not a big deal and say, oh, we just hooked up. And then if another group, you maybe had told them you were going to have sex or told them you were going to do a certain thing and you didn't have that opportunity with, the person you were with, you can say, oh, we totally hooked up, and keep it very vague.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly among boys, there's a lot of pressure on boys to prove their masculinity and prove mm-hmm. their heterosexuality by hooking up with a lot of women. Mm-hmm. So, boys and men. So that's, by keeping it vague, they can
mm-hmm.
still check the box and give people the impression they're participating in this and be a part of this, unofficial club that everyone seems to think is the way it should be.
Now,
and it'd be nice if they could interfere with that. It takes a lot of courage, a lot mm-hmm. of social courage to get off that train. But you often find people getting sick of it, particularly women, who kind of went through the pressures of it in high school, and then they got over it, and they stopped putting up with the pressure and started, choosing differently, but then they get to college and kind of the whole system kind of starts over again.
Mm-hmm.
And the assumption is that all boys and men love this hookup scene because they don't care, but actually, when you get them, they may, to be included and to be part of the scene with their friends, they may say that they love it, but when you get them with themselves, they're like, it's not mm-hmm. that great, and I'm expecting more, and I'm hoping for more. So emotional the lack of fulfillment emotionally is pretty equal among young men and women.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and that's an interesting component, because I wanted to know, when we look at this hookup culture, does it apply to all groups of young folks? I mean, cross-racial, cultural, socioeconomic lines, it's just a general culture that we're seeing in that particular demographic.
It crosses all, I think it's crossed all socioeconomic, certainly college atmosphere
mm-hmm.
that eliminates
mm-hmm.
them. But, outside of college, there's Tinder, there's all these dating apps.
Oh, yes.
Kids are using. And that's creeping down through the ages there. And that makes it even less personal. And you don't
mm-hmm.
have to have the courage to speak to someone directly. So, these days, everyone has access to porn and access to a phone, even if you don't have a home,
mm-hmm.
and even if you don't have access to food. Most kids will make a phone a priority because that is their link to their social world. And that has facilitated the hookup culture by kids, they don't have to quite have the courage to speak to someone directly.
Mm-hmm.
And, you walk into a bar with people in their mid-20s and early 30s, and everyone's head is down and
nice.
Swiping left and right. And You know, Aziz Ansari, this comedian, wrote a great book, and he talks about how he followed one guy who would never have had the courage to speak to the people he's swiping left on and rejecting on Tinder. He would never have had the courage to actually speak to that person in a bar. And, you know, I think what people don't, you know, by connecting through text, through a dating app, through any social media, means there's some emotional distance and safety, but once you're physically naked with someone, there's no app that can rescue you from that. You know, you're in there, and it is a, and it's awkward. And what I always say is, sex is awkward. Mm-hmm. Two naked people is a recipe for awkward. Mm-hmm. So, or even partially naked. And so, you know, and then where the expectation should be that you're going to discuss pleasure, and you're going to discuss, so for both partners, you're going to discuss, you know, safer sex and contraception and consent. So that's a lot to discuss, and it needs to be explicit. But the very nature of hooking up with someone you don't know well makes that communication even harder. And I always say, if you think it's awkward to talk about consent, then you should get your clothes back on. And if you think it's awkward to communicate to your partner what you enjoy, what gives you pleasure, then you shouldn't be naked with that person. But that's, you know, I think people are willing to put up with a lower level in hopes, you know, and they create the intimacy, but they go at it, it's reverse dating. They say, I would never want to date. That's such an old-fashioned thing. We just hook up, and after we hook up a few times, then we might be a thing.
Yes.
So it's a very backwards way that they think is low risk, and they say has no drama. Or that's the goal. You know, I really, really can do this without drama. But really, there's almost always drama that comes attached with hooking up.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Where do you find most young folks obtain information about their bodies, obtain information about sex?
About their bodies and
about
sex?
Their bodies and about sex.
Yeah. So porn is the number one sexuality educator.
Okay.
And so many parents defer, like they just hope for the best. They want to cross their fingers and they want to depend on school or the pediatrician. So part of it is that parents aren't talking to them before Google, before they get to Google. So the average age, when I wrote my first book, Sexploitation, the average age, that was just in 2015, was that a boy in the U.S. looked at porn was 11. And then by the time that book went to the publisher and I started my college book, there was starting to be evidence, both anecdotally in my world of people and parents, as well as in the research, that the average age was 9.
Hold your thoughts for 1 second. We're going to take a brief break. If you're just tuning in, the program is 411 Teen. This hour, I'm talking with Cindy Pierce, author of Sex, College, and Social Media, A Common Sense Guide to Navigating the Hookup Culture. Cindy, we were just talking before we went on break about where teens, young folks receive the information on sex, and you were saying that most of it is through social media, through porn that they access on the net, right?
Yeah. So internet porn's the kind of the first stop for kids because, and it's going early and earlier because kids are hearing things, you know, at school, on the bus. We're talking about elementary school kids who there's a lot of information going around, even if they don't have a phone yet and they are not on social media. They're hearing a lot of sexualized material, you know, on TV, in YouTube videos, in just around. It's just so prevalent. So they want to understand what things are, and they feel like they should, but it's their parents haven't really talked to them about the basics of sex. So they end up Googling. I can't tell you how many parents have contacted me. At this time last year, I heard from multiple parents who said, I just found in my kid's history, you know, it started with boobs, or mm-hmm. boobies, and then by day 7 or day 8 on that history, it's gone to a whole extreme kind of thing. Because, you know, the porn industry, they're really set up. You know, they understand that these Google searches, they can quickly engage you in this material, and it's very visual, and particularly for boys who are more visual, are caught into it. But girls are on this, too. And, you know, I've heard teenage girls, you know, and who say, oh, well, I look at porn because, you know, guys think it's cool. I look at porn to get sex ideas. I look at porn to see what guys like. So in a lot of ways, heterosexual girls are actually put into a position of competing with porn.
Mm-hmm.
And it's
mm-hmm.
interesting that lesbian porn is not actually made for lesbians. It's mm-hmm. made for men who are interested in seeing
indeed.
That. So, you know, it's porn is different than a drug. Like a drug, you need more of a drug, and with porn to make it stay interesting, it needs to be different. So the porn industry has a built-in situation where they can just come up with new material, mm-hmm. and that's where the stakes get higher and the more violence and rape simulation and mm-hmm. you know, choking and hitting, and that's where it's really mm-hmm. it's really taken a turn. And that's the most viewed porn. So, you know, and people always say, is there healthy porn out there? Deep on the internet, there's feminist porn. There's porn that's more instructional, you know. But it's not the first thing you see. And I think it's really hard to skip all the tempting things.
Mm-hmm.
To get to the things that don't get clicked that much. But it is out there.
Well, that ties right into your first chapter, where I think it's the misinformation, how the media warps expectations.
Mm-hmm.
Because if that's where they're getting their information on sex, that's certainly misinformation. It's not reality at all.
Yeah.
So they're starting behind the eight ball with this misinformation. Plus, pornography has an effect on healthy relationships later, and that's something that you didn't touch on, but I know you wrote about it in your book, because if you were exposed to a lot of pornography early, it can impact what you call a healthy relationship later.
Yeah, and I hear that from mm-hmm. guys who stop looking at porn or who really start to say, you know, I'm 19 and I have erectile dysfunction.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, you know what, I didn't know what to do, so I stopped looking at porn to see if that would help, and it did. And the studies, they tried to do a study of college-age men who do not look at porn, and they couldn't find a study group, so they changed the study to be, I know. And I remember the first time, you know, 12 years ago or 11 years ago, I was interviewing a group of guys. And there was one guy in the room that was famous because he didn't look at porn. He had come from northern New England, you know, up in Maine, and
mm-hmm.
had dial-up. And he was like, yeah, I started not looking at porn and using my imagination and never got onto it. And he was considered famous. And at that time, there was a real, even those young men were unsettled by mm-hmm. the idea that there was a couple guys they knew who couldn't masturbate without porn, and they thought that was really strange, and they still were looking at it some of the time, but not all the time. But it's really, porn starts to dictate what is running through your highlight reel, your fantasy reel, whatever is in your head, and I think a lot of guys recognize that, you know, and the people who freak out about, you know, I'm not trying to stop the porn industry. It can't, you know, 30 to 35% of what crosses the internet is porn.
Mm-hmm.
I don't believe we can stop the industry, but I want to educate the viewers and the consumers of porn, and so that they're prepared for, you know, how they're getting off track, and they know it. You know, they feel inadequate about their bodies because, you know, for women, they surgically alter the women. They surgically alter their labias.
Mm-hmm.
And these surgeries are now offered to the and are growing because of the demand, because people who look at porn have an idea of how bodies should look and put that pressure on their partners that they don't look quite right. So there's been a huge surge in vaginal rejuvenation, and there's multiple surgeries that people have to look like people in porn. And among the men in porn, have, like, the average size penis in porn is 8 inches, and the average size penis in the world is 5.5 inches. And, you know, once I had a guy in a fraternity leap from his chair and cheer and high-five his friends. He said, that's what I needed to hear. Because who is talking to them about
right.
the other side?
Exactly. Exactly. Well, what can parents do? What suggestions do you have that parents may intervene or at least interject some?
You know, I think really what it starts with, and I went with this, with my pediatrician, must have gotten this information when no one else, you know, in our area had. And he, when my son is about to be 19, and when he was in kindergarten, the pediatrician said they're now recommending that we talk to kids about sex between the ages of 5 and 7.
Mm-hmm.
And so many people my age resisted that. And I decided to do it with all three of my kids, and it didn't go well. I mean, it's awkward and weird, and each one responded differently. And I kept thinking, oh, I got this down now, and I'm really comfortable talking about this stuff. But you don't know what they're going to ask or how they're going to react. And, I find all those mistakes and mishaps entertaining and part of the process.
Yeah.
But parents resist that, and they say, but I learned in fifth grade. And then they get to fifth grade, and they realize their kid is super knowledgeable.
Mm-hmm.
Or they say, my kid hasn't asked questions. My kid isn't interested. And
that's
so when you start talking to them about sex, when they're kind of at the age where they have crushes,
mm-hmm.
it's much more difficult. But when you talk, it really paid off. So by the time my kids were 9, there was no topic we weren't able to discuss. And they knew I was a reliable resource, and they... You know, and so I got to them before Google got to them.
Yeah.
And
that's
so
the key. That's the secret.
That's the key. But parents don't want to hear it because...
How do we get parents to that point? I mean, because
that's what my first
you're the minority. I mean, you know, majority of parents don't feel that way.
Right.
You know,
right.
Just even talking about the subject is taboo. And it's real. Let's have a reality check. By the time a child gets to fifth grade, he knows all that there is to know just about.
Right.
He really does.
Right.
He or she, okay?
Yeah.
So
it's,
what do we do? I mean, I feel you and agree, and I guess I'm just, you know, this is just rhetorical, but what do we do? How do we get parents to a point where they may always be uncomfortable, but they need to recognize the importance and the significance of maybe they may not know.
You know, I think
they might not.
It's people think it's one talk with their kids, but actually
mm-hmm.
the recommendation is to have many conversations.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I work with a pediatrician, and we are doing presentations together. And his theory is the way we used to not talk about helmets, and the way we used to not talk about, you know, taking care of our skin, and the way we didn't used to, but now we make that part of the conversation. And the, just in the way we talk to kids about respect and, you know, being kind and doing unto others as you would do unto yourself. Those kinds of conversations also need to be about healthy bodies and healthy sex. And we wonder why girls are particularly, the messages from the culture are so overwhelming to girls from such a young age that if we don't have conversations about sex and bodies, then they really have to rely on the culture. And then we get to them when it's too late.
Yeah.
And if so, when we're unwilling to have the conversation, and then we say, well, you know, how could this possibly be? It has to be a proactive approach. And one of my favorite sexuality educators is Deborah Rothman. Debbie Rothman she wrote a book called Talk to Me First and Sex and Sensibility. And she lays it down really clearly how step by step how and why we need to have these conversations. And then for older kids, if you've missed the window,
mm-hmm.
You know, you still have to start. Even if your kid's 17 and about to go to college, pediatricians are saying, start then.
Mm-hmm.
And they say, but it would be so awkward. And it's hard if you don't want to have unpleasantness. We're so scared of having an unpleasant experience with our kids, especially when they're teenagers, and it doesn't always go well, and they're kind of salty and irritable. And then you're going to bring up something that's embarrassing and awkward. I always say, get in awkward soup, swim to the other side. After you've done it once, you'll be better the next time. Your kids get used to you being awkward. It's a process that takes, I mean, I'm still having conversations. My kids are all teenagers now, and they know they can talk to me about everything. And they don't share their personal stories, but they, if they have general questions, and there's nothing any of us would hesitate to say in front of each other because we did it early. So I think that really is the key, but it's a matter of parents.
Parents have to feel comfortable. That's right.
What's that?
I said parents have to feel comfortable. That's part of it, too. I mean, or have at least a reality approach, because they may feel some discomfort.
Right.
Okay?
Right.
And if they recognize that, that's normal. But what I'm doing is much more significant, much more important, because this is a period of vulnerability for these young teens and even young adults. You know, body image is so important.
Even more so now with with the internet and social media. You know, I think Peggy Ornstein talks about, you know, a girl who said she posted pictures of her puppy or cool sunset, and she never got many likes, but she noticed all her friends who post sexy pictures get tons of comments and likes. Mm-hmm. And so she did an experiment and straightened her beautiful thick hair, put on a ton of makeup, made a sexy picture, takes a shot, and within minutes has a bunch of comments and a bunch of likes. And how does, if how you look is your currency, social currency, and your sexual currency, how do you back off from that? Once you've gotten that much validation through social media, it's really hard to go back to your pictures of your puppy and your sunsets. And so Peggy Ornstein, who wrote Girls and Sex, really points out a lot of the things that I really resonate. Like, when I met her this fall, and she, her philosophy very much aligns with mine, and the need for girls, you know, her message, and this is what I've been talking to girls about, is you talk about empowerment and liberation, but when I go talk to sororities, when I go talk to groups of women, I find that they've been sexually active for years, and they're not putting their own pleasure first. And that's my thing, is you need to know your body, you need to know your pleasure zones, and be able to communicate that to your partner. And so don't talk about sexual liberation and this empowerment that you can hook up with whom you want, if you're not really in touch with what you want, and you're just providing services. I always say, we're not here to provide services, ladies. Like, this is not what we're doing. And they say, but that would be awkward. I say, well, yes, communicating about sex, it is awkward, but you will get more comfortable, and there's ways to get around that and to really, you know, get around that awkwardness while still communicating.
I think an operative word, though, that you mentioned is communicating, because communication is a key. And that's a key whether they're talking with sexual partners, they're talking with parents, is do they communicate effectively and clearly and concisely today? I'm thinking particularly because we don't communicate like we used to. Now they have texting and the dating apps that many folks use, where before we could write or we could talk. And there wasn't anything else. I mean, do you see that just even the patterns of communication have an impact on the whole reality check and expectations?
Absolutely. I mean, it is keeping at a distance, and the things, it's very, sometimes very direct, what people will write to each other about what they want to do with each other, and so there's this swagger people have behind a screen when they don't have to see the person face-to-face, and they type and send without thinking, and then they find themselves, you know, having to communicate. They want the intimacy, but the expected way to get that is to freely put this stuff out there through text and on, you know, make these comments and posting things, and this is how you get someone engaged and connected with you. And that emotional distance gives people a lot more courage to say things, and it's not real courage. It's a false courage.
Well, one important characteristic that we have not even addressed with this whole texting and the internet is that once you put it out there, it's out there.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And these young folks are in the process of applying for jobs or applying to college. And colleges now are checking.
Yeah.
They're checking internets to see what you have put out there. And
right.
That follows you and stays with you forever.
Right. It's like a tattoo. You can remove it, but it's still out there.
It's still out there.
Mm-hmm. I've heard two stories that really sink in. You know, so sending them nude pictures
mm-hmm.
that kids think, well, and we as adults will say to kids, do you know that that's illegal? That's the distribution of porn, you know, for under
mm-hmm.
18 kids. We also say, you're trying to get a job. That could be out there. And they don't find these warnings. You could be on a sex offender list. They don't find these warnings even, they don't register with them because
right.
most of their friends are doing this and not getting caught.
Mm-hmm.
So that approach isn't always helpful. But even when lawyers come and talk to kids and they say, do you understand that if someone's phone is being looked at for some other reason, it's been taken and
mm-hmm.
now they're looking through to check history on one thing, if your naked picture or your comments are connected, you are now part of that loop, and you that's a great risk. And then if they find a naked picture, they are obligated, whether they're a police officer, whether they're a lawyer, whether they're a counselor, whether they're the therapist, they are obligated to follow that up and check that out.
Hold your thoughts for a minute. Cindy, we're going to take a break. You're tuned in to 411 Teen. We'll get right back at you.
Views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and contributors and not necessarily those of WFSU Public Media.
If you're just tuning in, the program is 411 Teen. I'm Dr. Liz Holyfield, and I'm talking with the author, Cindy Pierce, of Sex, College, and Social Media, A Common Sense Guide to Navigating the Hookup Culture. Cindy, I had to interrupt you. I'm sorry, but
no
you
problem.
May continue your thought.
Well, I heard two stories that were interesting, that one young woman had, you know, so many young women say, well, this guy asked for a nude picture, and he said it would just be between us. And most guys I know say, well, I keep a whole stash of them, and I share them with my friends,
mm-hmm.
and pass them around. And one young woman sent a picture, a nude picture, but she put emojis over her nipples and her crotch.
Mm-hmm.
And thinking that it was, you know, she wasn't really sending a nude picture. And she did send it to a boyfriend, and the boyfriend showed it to one friend. That friend took the picture and found an app that can remove emojis, and then he took the naked picture and distributed it widely. So in another situation where a 19-year-old woman, two women, someone contacted them and said, I saw a nude picture of you as a young girl. When they were 14, they had sent a nude picture and forgot about that and assumed it had just gone between them. And now 5 years later, someone found these photos on a Russian kiddie porn site. So now these images, they cannot control what's happening in this other country, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, that's the thing. It's a risk, but we need to keep pointing out and showing kids where that risk is. And I think the naive, you know, people in their 20s say, well, you know, what do you mean to someone in their 20s? What do you mean you could get a nude picture in a minute? They said, in 15 minutes I could get a picture. So this one older guy said, well, you're telling me in 15 minutes you could, and he sends out three requests, and within 15 minutes, he's got three nude pictures from women, grown
mm-hmm.
women. So
mm-hmm.
here's where we, like, certainly men are objectified in porn and objectified in the world and in marketing and media, but women, the continued pressure that your sexual relevance, your social relevance depends on your willingness to engage this way and objectify yourself. And some women will say, but I'm really proud of my body, and I should be able to share it freely. It's the real question is, well, if you were truly confident, like you're saying, why would you need that much validation? Why would that
That's
be
right.
how your only chance to connect with someone sexually? So there's a lot of mixed up messages. And
well, Cindy, really, I loved your book. I mean, I want to tell you I applaud your efforts in writing this book. I found it to be accurate. I thought it was well written. It was a very thorough resource. So I just wanted you to know that. I thought it was very well done.
Thank you.
I like the chapter topics. For example, one of the most important chapters, I think, was the one you had titled, let me think, Unplugging, relating to something other than your phone. And I think that all your chapters are important. I don't mean to convey that. But I think it's so important for today's young folks because they're so connected to social media. As you mentioned earlier on the program, they are, you know, that phone is connected to the hip, okay? I saw a couple out in a restaurant, and they obviously were there as a couple. They were sitting across each other. He was on his phone. She was on her phone. I don't know if they were texting each other or what. Every once in a while, they would look up and smile and laugh, and then they looked back down on their phones until their food came.
That's so painful. People don't know how to just have conversations.
I know.
And I think that's important is we say to people, you need to be able to read cues in a sexual situation and understand consent and give and speak. But if we can't do that at 2 o'clock in the afternoon in broad daylight, how are we going to do that under the covers, under the influence of alcohol and optimistic arousal? Like, that combination makes it hard to read those cues. And, I really encourage kids of all ages and my friends to not, like, when you pull out your phone in a group, you're basically saying there are more important things going on here. I say it to my kids, and it's an ongoing conversation of, I always say, engage with the people you're with. Put your phone down. Put it aside. You don't have to respond to this. And adults say it to their kids and say, oh, but I'm the important person earning the money to keep this family going, so I should be able to look at my phone because I'm such a busy, important person. Whereas kids, they feel so resentful to parents who give that message. And, you know, we in our house, I actually made the rule. I didn't even bring it up in a family meeting. I just said from 7 to 9, you're doing homework but on a screen, but we're not going to have our phones, all of us. We're going to turn them off. And it's made a difference. It makes it more noisy, but we're more engaged. And when we're in the car, I don't, no phones. One person can put their phone in and we can listen to music on that phone, but everyone's together rather than apart.
Yeah, but again, you know, I'm talking to you, I'm talking to the choir.
Yeah.
I mean, the majority of the people, a majority of families are not, and parents are not operating in that manner. And that's...
But I think there is a little shift going on because now parents, I'm like, now that I speak with people with kids in elementary school, I'm starting to see a change. You know, there's, I think kids age 20 to 35, people age 20 to 35, adults, they grew up before parents were talking, having these conversations, before parents were that aware. The social media and the technologies kind of got away from us and we let it run. And then parents, now we're starting to see the permanent issues that are happening for kids, you know, whether it's porn and how it's really screwing people up and their long-term relationships and their level of intimacy is impacted. And so now parents are starting to open their minds and they're willing. But the conversation needs to be coming up. I also find when I suggest to college students, they all agree. None of them say, oh, you're so... But no one's on duty. There's no referee. There's no lifeguard on duty on social media. It's a free-for-all, and they're monitoring themselves. And you know, they feel if they don't comment and if they don't respond and they don't engage, they miss out on so many things. Yet, at the same time, they say, gosh, I wish I could get off social media. So when someone mm-hmm. suggests it, they're actually so receptive. They agree. And it almost has to be someone says it to them, it becomes part of the conversation, and then I hear from students, they say, you know what? We all went out, and we all stacked our phones up, and we had a conversation, and we made a point to do that. So if we keep that, if we keep these conversations going, and I know it feels like we're always preaching to the choir, talking to people, but some people just need someone to point to the exit ramp. Mm-hmm. They're going to keep going because no one's questioning it, but if someone brings it up, or another article comes out, or another interview, or another piece of research, that triggers behaviors, and we just need to just put that out there more and more. Because people are starved for intimacy. That's what they're looking for, but they just keep thinking, somewhere in this phone I'm going to reach what I'm looking for.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the slow down, be in your own head, face the people, read their cues, meaning their body language, their voice tone, their facial expressions. So I think if we keep having the conversation, I think it's going to start to connect with parents who are going to be a little more proactive about the phone use.
Well, that ties into my next question, because I know you have spoken at a number of schools across the country. You've been interviewed on NPR here and now. And you've talked to a number of parents and students. Can you identify any common trends or themes that you are now encountering with your interaction with young folks and parents?
Okay, there's a lot of things. You know, I think, so here's one thing. So we all talk about we want to reduce sexual assault.
Mm-hmm.
And the military, ahead of colleges, have really found that by addressing sexual harassment, you reduce sexual assault. And I think to stop sexual harassment and bullying below that is not tolerating the microaggressions of little comments and words that people use and disrespect and, you know, racist comments, sexist comments, homophobic, transphobic, all these little things that so many adults and teachers and educators and coaches tend to think they want to focus on the harassment and the bullying and look for that. But what they're not recognizing is that if you address those things with younger kids and older kids, mm-hmm. you know, if you don't bring that up, then you're telling kids that they're allowed to be this way. And then that fuels, you know, more aggressive behavior that's, you know, that leads to the harassment and the bullying. So I think one theme I always talk about, you know, it takes social courage to call someone out. And
yeah.
So many parents say, you better, when they send their kids off to college, you better have the courage to stop a sexual assault. I have talked to kids who have stopped sexual assaults. I'm talking about confident kids who, with a lot of social credibility and a lot of social currency on their campus and captains of their teams, you know, who have intervened, and that is a very challenging thing. And they actually say it's the hardest thing I ever did, you know, addressing this. But it's becoming more accepted to intervene and to stop two people. But if we don't give kids the practice to call each other out about this disrespect and the homophobia and all of these things and the words,
mm-hmm.
you know, that we tolerate this kind of language, that is a big part of our problem. And if we can hold people accountable for that, but that means speaking directly to someone and making an awkward situation. And parents who are telling their kids to do it aren't necessarily calling their peers at work out for these kinds of things. So
yeah.
I think that kind of thing, you know, making it acceptable, creating a culture of respect in your family, in your school, in your community, means calling people out for those things. And I think that's a big piece of it. So and I think social media has interfered with our practice of social courage.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we need to actively teach our kids to do this, and we need to model it and show our kids that we can get into an uncomfortable situation or conversation, survive it, and still go back and do it again.
Yeah, well, which leads to, and you touched on it, what role does the school play? You have sex, sexuality, or the whole self-esteem and dating and body image, and it goes on, and decision-making. All of this can only be enhanced with accurate, appropriate education. So what role does the school play?
Now, I think, in high school and elementary school and public schools, parents are the primary sexuality educators. Mm-hmm. And because they don't really want to do it, they tend to blame the school and depend on the school. But public schools are limited by what they can say. Parents complain. I taught in an elementary school for many years. And some parents are saying you're not doing enough to talk about this, and some mm-hmm. parents are saying you're doing too much and you shouldn't be saying that for my kids. So it's very limiting what you can do. And I remember teaching fifth and sixth grade and how tricky it is to give them accurate information. So something's going to need to change so that schools can do this. But at this point where we are right now, it's not the school's responsibility. If a school has a program, that is great. You know, they teach this they used to call it sex ed, now they call it puberty education. My son came home and said, Mom, do you think they call it that because they're not comfortable? Parents aren't comfortable? I said, exactly why they call it that.
Puberty.
So we've almost gone, like in the 70s and even the 80s, in the beginning of the 80s, they were more proactive about sex ed.
Mm-hmm.
But it's gotten gotten trickier. Parents mm-hmm. are really complaining about it. So there's great programs like Our Whole Lives, which is really effective. It's been around for years. And it's a program but the U of U, you know, the Universal U of U Church started, and the UC, I'm spacing out the two churches who teach these programs and started these programs. And that means, but it's now kids are so overcommitted with sports and lessons and SAT prep that they don't have time to take something like that.
Right.
But I have interviewed kids and the people who teach it, and I am so impressed. These kids have a sense of themselves. They are great communicators. They are knowledgeable. They're grounded kids who are going to make good choices because they're informed. And so I think that if parents aren't willing to do it, they've got to have a program that does it. And, you know, I'm working with Dr. Michael Lyons, my kid's pediatrician, actually, and he and I have been frustrated for so long about how parents are deferring mm-hmm. the sex ed and why they're deferring and that kids with limited information, how that looks for them when they get into their 20s and how scary it is. And I think there's so much pressure to be if you're a smart kid, that you should be able to figure out sex. And these parents who are bright, educated people think, well, I am smart enough to do this job, so I don't need any help or guidance to teach sex ed or to, I should be able to figure that out on my own. And yet they don't do it. And they say, oh, my kids, I think they've got it figured out. And so there's all this avoidance.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. Cindy, in the last, minute and a half, first of all, share with us where we can get your book.
Okay, my book, you can get it on Amazon. You can get it, all the places, Barnes & Noble. You can ask for it in your local bookstore and they can order it. I encourage people to support local bookstores, independent bookstores in their communities. So there's a variety of ways they can do that.
Okay. We are talking with Cindy Pierce, author of Sex, College and Social Media, A Common Sense Guide to Navigating the Hookup Culture. My listening audience, I encourage you to check it out. It is a thorough, well-written resource. Cindy, there's so many more questions that I'd like to ask, but I guess we are just about out of time. I'll have to invite you to come back. You know, we didn't talk about the LGBTQ community, and it goes on and on, but we are out of time. So I'd like to extend my sincere appreciation to you. That's it for this edition of 411 Teen. Many thanks to Cindy Pierce. To my listening audience, tune in next week, same time, same place, to get the 411 on 411 Teen. This edition of 411 Teen was produced by Dr. Liz Hollyfield. Technical assistant, Ken Smith. Audio copies are available, and if you want to participate in 411 Teen or have suggestions for discussion topics, call 1-800-829-8809, extension 358. If you would like to subscribe to 411 Teen podcast, log in wfsu.org. Check us out on Facebook.